Hello and welcome to the Eclipsing History Podcast, a podcast where we explore the social, cultural, and political significance of eclipses through the diverse cultures of North America.
This is episode 3, Written in the Stars. You can find the entire series and additional information at pgsu.edu/eclipsinghistory.
Today on Eclipsing History, we will discuss how and why Indigenous knowledge predates, influences, and is no less important than modern scientific theory, specifically in the field of astronomy.
In the year 1902, the Reverend Landon West published an inspired article declaring the greater serpent as identical to the one of notoriety in Moses' Genesis. He said the earthwork was created directly by God to remind humanity of their proverbial fall from grace, intimating that this land of the West was where the first people struggled and prospered, an ancient and similar belief held by Native Americans. Interestingly, Reverend West of Pleasant Hill, Ohio, believed the serpent to be in the act of swallowing a fruit from the tree of life. Perhaps the good minister didn't realize the full implications of the prophetic message, for harder evidence linking Adams Garden to Adams County has become curiously apparent.
Every culture has looked to the stars for some important tradition, to explain the world surrounding them, to worship, to symbolize their folklore. The Serpent Mound Earthwork in Ohio, a newly designated UNESCO World Heritage Site, is one example of this tradition, known in academic circles as ethnoastronomy. While archaeological evidence now suggests that the indigenous peoples of Ohio constructed this effigy to align with celestial events such as the solstices and equinoxes, others have connected the structure to more modern Western traditions. In the early 1900s, the Reverend Landon West believed that the snake-like figure marked the physical location of the Garden of Eden and that Noah's flood washed away the surrounding soil to reveal the Mark of Eden as a warning from God against the fall of man. Despite most believing by this point that the mound was constructed by Native Americans, West insisted that indigenous people would not have had the knowledge or ability to construct something so perfect. So it must have been constructed by a purer race of true native Ohioans prior to the Great Flood and prior to the arrival of the indigenous people inhabiting America today. This story is just one example of how Western society has overlooked indigenous knowledge and their contributions to sciences such as astronomy. While many view indigenous knowledge as primitive, backward, or superstitious, throughout this episode, we will see that indigenous cultures have a deep understanding of astronomical events, knowledge that they have used for centuries for tracking seasons, agriculture, hunting, festivals, and more. That is not unlike Western astronomy.
Indigenous groups and people who fall outside of the sphere of Western thought have always had their own unique ways of understanding the skies. Western people may try to superimpose or squeeze their beliefs into indigenous perspectives, as seen in the case of the Serpent Mound story. This is done in an attempt to better understand indigenous knowledge, but there is a better way to do that. In fact, there is a term that will help us understand the relationship between indigenous knowledge and understanding that knowledge: ethnoastronomy. There are a few definitions out there, but ethnoastronomy can be defined as the study of a specific culture's understanding of the sky and how they use or use the knowledge they gained. Wherever you are listening from, look to the sky. What do you see? If it is nighttime, do you see stars? Do these stars mean anything to you? Many of us have been taught to look for the constellations in the sky, each denoting different legends in our cultures. Some of you may look to the stars for guidance, for navigation, for farming, for the time, for the season. Certainly our ancestors did. Regardless of what we see, the stars speak something to each of us, across cultural, ethnic, and national boundaries. This meaning we find in the stars is known in academic circles as ethnoastronomy. Not only is it hard to understand different cultures' understandings of astronomy, but what about cultures that aren't around anymore? Luckily, there's something called archaeoastronomy for that. Simply put, archaeoastronomy is the archaeological and historical study of a people's past and astronomical knowledge and their related practices. These concepts have been important for scholars and their understanding of ancient societies, but Dr. John Henderson, professor of anthropology at Cornell University, emphasizes the following.
I would emphasize that in both cases, archaeoastronomy and ethnoastronomy, you're getting an academic view, or it's particularly important to remain aware of that in thinking about ethnoastronomy, because it's an outsider's view. Although the subject is indigenous astronomy, and that's what ethnoastronomers want to understand, they are inevitably framing it in terms of academic astronomy's understanding of things. So it's not quite the indigenous view.
Now that we have established that there is a difference between indigenous viewpoints and what academics think about indigenous viewpoints, it is important to note that indigenous perspectives vary depending on the group, country, or region. In conducting different interviews for this podcast, we learned about multiple different indigenous perspectives on eclipses. Some of these perspectives include the Audum community from Durango, Mexico, the Eastern Shawnee tribe from Oklahoma, the Miamia or Miami tribe of Oklahoma, and accounts of the Maya and Mexica in Mexico and Central America. While there may be some connections or similarities between their beliefs about the sky and stars, each group brings a different perspective to the table. Esteban Rios, a teacher in the Audum indigenous community in Durango, Mexico, offers his community's perspective.
Bueno, de hecho, pues bueno, la sociedad más...
Well, in fact, the most ancestral society, well, they revere the stars a lot, you know. Maybe not so much nowadays, but it used to be somewhat notable. So there is some reverence or festivals, direct activities aimed at the sun or the moon, but they are not very emphasized, you know. But maybe they do it in some way to help improve the crops or ask the moon for abundant water to ensure good harvest.
While the Audum revere the stars during festivals and harvest time, the Eastern Shawnee see everything in the night sky as equal and opposite forces. However, they also hold a similar belief to the Audum in the sense that eclipses can signify agricultural or environmental change. Callan Silverhorn, a member of the Eastern Shawnee tribe and the cultural program manager of the Ohio Parks and Recreation Department, explains how his tribe views the night sky.
In our way of thinking, there are equal and opposite forces to pretty much everything. And so the sun and the moon also help represent those. Night, day, hot, cold, up, down, left, right. These things are all equal, but they're not identical. And so a lot of our symbolism, our artworks represent this duality, the inequality of that duality, but the balance of it, that things can be equal without having to be a mirror image, without having to be synonymous. And so things like eclipses that bridge that gap, that bring two things that are supposed to be separate together, you know, those do play a part in our cosmology and understanding of the world, that these are times that the world is sort of changing. Things are being mixed up together. In our traditions, the eclipse is usually talked about or depicted as the sky world and lower world sort of colliding and the beings of those worlds sort of being present at the same time, which is not something that happens too often. And so it usually represents a micro prophecy, you know, where like this is a sign, this is a designation that things are going to change, something is going to happen in the world. And so sometimes that's war and conflict, sometimes that's illness, sometimes that's political change, sometimes it's agricultural or environmental, but something in our world is going to change.
Similar to how the Eastern Shawnee believe in the duality, balance, and interconnectedness of the sky, Miamia people also believe that everything is interconnected. George Ironstrack, assistant director of the Miamia Center at Miami University, describes how the Miami tribe of Oklahoma views the sky.
For Miamia people, those of us deeply engaged in cultural revitalization, Miamionge, our place as a people, isn't like a two-dimensional flat landscape. It's three-dimensional. It includes what's beneath the surface, and it includes the sky around us. They're all connected. So whether it's the constellations that we look up and see in the night sky, or the Milky Way that reminds us of our ancestors who came before, for us, our place is all around us, up, down, and all around. And the lunar calendar system is a way in which we've organized ourselves to follow the progress of time, month time, and seasonal time within our place. And so, you know, when you think about, let's say, maple sugaring in the spring, connected to one or two lunar months, Mohkunza Kielspa, the little black bear moon, and Andekwa Kielspa, the crow moon, our behavior of going into the woods and tapping trees and harvesting maple sap to then produce maple syrup and maple sugar is interlocked with the following of the behavior of the animals around us, or in the case of black bear, the animals that used to be around us in larger numbers than they are today. And so the lunar calendar, as we follow its progress, we're reminded to think about the changes in the place around us, behavior of the animals around us, the changes in the plants, but that's communicated by looking up at the sky and looking at the relative position of constellations, depending on the hour of the night it is. And then, of course, the growth and death of the moon each month, so that the sky has an integral role in helping us follow the progress of that ecological time.
According to Ironstrack, the Miamia lunar calendar is integral to life. John Henderson, whom we met earlier this episode, describes the Mesoamerican 260-day lunar calendar that is still in use in many Central American countries and cultures today.
They use the 260-day cycle, which is in function as a divinatory calendar, like an astrological calendar. Its only real function is to schedule important ritual activities and to make sure you understand what mood the supernatural is in at any given point, and you alter your behavior accordingly. But that calendar probably owes its origin to astronomical kinds of things, to the length of time between zenith passages, for example. And indigenous people in Mesoamerica today still pay attention to zenith passages of the sun, because in many parts of Mesoamerica, they'll happen twice a year, and the timing of it falls near the beginning of the agricultural season and near harvest time. So it's kind of both a symbolic and now it's time to do X marker. Lots of other kinds of things still go on that people pay attention to eclipses. They still relate to them. They think of them the same way as ancient Mesoamericans did, in terms of either animals or monsters devouring the sun.
While it is impossible to encapsulate all indigenous perspectives, these are just a few examples we pulled to show the difference in beliefs and cultures across North America. Let's take a trip to Ohio so that we can hear about how the concepts of ethno-archaeoastronomy may apply there, as well as learn a little bit more about the Serpent Mound. From North America, we are going to focus on Ohio and the indigenous people's experiences and contributions regarding astronomy in what we now consider Ohio. Specifically, I will be covering mound building across Ohio, and even more specifically, the Serpent Mound found in Adams County, Ohio. So, what is the Serpent Mound? What does it look like? What does it mean? Serpent Mound is an earthwork, a monument built into the earth, the structure described as laid out in a clay and ash mixture first, and then clay was heaped up over this foundation, and was smartly reinforced with stone to defend against erosion. The park in which it resides houses an old iron tower, allowing visitors to get an overhead view of the sprawling creature. Most beautiful are the snake's spiraling tail, the three main coils, which some claim offer astronomical alignment, and the head, or egg, or eye, of the sun, which faces the summer solstice sunset during annual celebrations. The quarter-mile-long snake occupies the saddle of a ridge near a set of ancient burial mounds. Its earthen form seems to slither westward, its head abruptly overhanging the edge of an enormous crater. This snake has rested here for nearly 1,000 years, the solstice alignment suggesting that one of the effigy's purposes was to mark the turning of the year so that planting, gathering, and hunting could be planned. But the serpent certainly had other meanings for its builders, who were connected to the widespread Mississippian cultural world. The Mississippian cultural world, as some call it, is the area that surrounds the vast Mississippi River and the indigenous cultures that made up this world during pre-European contact, including the people who lived around the Ohio River, which Adams County touches, as an extension of the Mississippi. Brad Lepper, a senior archaeologist for the World Heritage Program at Ohio History Connection, mentions this.
There's currently some debate in the archaeology community about the age of Serpent Mound, but I'm convinced it was built 1,000 years ago, not 2,000 years ago. I think the iconography and the symbolism and the configuration, the scale of this relates to the Mississippian culture. So Ohio, that would be the Fort Ancient culture that was contemporary with that. So I think Serpent Mound was built by the Fort Ancient culture. And I've worked with some colleagues from the Missouri area, work with the Osage Indians who do have these connections with the Mississippian culture and Cahokia in particular. And I think there is symbolism on Picture Cave in Missouri, pictographs that parallel the imagery at Serpent Mound, which I think has been misunderstood, because many people think it's a serpent with an egg in its mouth. But there was much more to the head than simply the oval. There was a wishbone-shaped mound on the other side of the oval that sort of made this an overall composition. And based on very similar imagery from Picture Cave, my colleagues and I think that Serpent Mound is a representation of the same thing that's painted on Picture Cave. And it's a creation story whereby first woman mates with the great serpent and thereby acquires his powers, which she uses to create all life on earth. And the Serpent Mound and this one particular panel at Picture Cave sort of represent that pivotal moment in cosmic history when first woman acquires those powers to create life.
Astronomically, the sightline of the serpent's head aligns with the sun's meridian transit, meaning the moment in time when a celestial body crosses the observer's longitude with a 10-minute variation. With the sun specifically, meridian transit occurs every day at local apparent noon, which varies place to place due to the use of time zones, and is directly south of the observer at the latitude of, in this case, Serpent Mound. The instant of the sun's meridian transit, or local apparent noon, can be determined either by the calculation or observation of the shortest length of a shadow cast by the sun. This relates to Hopewell Mound building, in which Hopewell earthworks were intentionally aligned to celestial events like solstice or lunar sandstill event. This is the same with Hopewell charnel houses, a building in which human remains were stored, meaning the Hopewell would align both earthworks and culturally significant buildings with astronomical events. It is argued that these houses were astronomically aligned intentionally because of the connections in Hopewell belief that the moon and its phases, death, and rebirth. The sun and the moon are often opposite to the way in which many indigenous cultures, which includes the sun being the primary life giver and the moon being the opposite, associated more with death, which leaves a potential connection with that of the Hopewell charnel houses and their connection to astronomy, alignment, and the moon. In contrast, Brad Lepper, who I had mentioned before, talks about the rather inconclusive nature of the Serpent Mound alignment. Does find it likely that it is aligned over the sun?
One alignment that seems clear is the head appears to be aligned to the sunset on the summer solstice. There are three principal curves of the body, and some speculate that those curves are lined up to the summer solstice sunrise, the equinox, and the winter solstice sunrise, which may well be true. But other people say, no, they're lined up to the northernmost rise of the moon, the midpoint in the lunar cycle, and the southernmost half of the moon. And then there's some people that say, isn't it amazing that they could make these earthworks aligned to all those things? But it's like, no, those alignments are different. So it's lined up to one or the other or none at all. And the problem with the curves of the body is the sight lines are so short and you're sort of standing there looking at a curve. So you can't really define a foresight and a backsight to make a precise alignment. So you can stand in one place and say, oh yes, it's aligned to the summer solstice sunrise. But if you take half a step to the right or something, suddenly it's like, oh no, look, it's lined up to the moon. So given that it's related to Mississippi and given that they do have this focus on the sun, I think it's likely that those coils, those curves of the body are probably lined up to the sun, but you can't make a convincing archaeoastronomical argument. Definitely are deliberately built that way.
In the end, it is important to note, no matter the true cultural meaning behind the Serpent Mound effigy, it can be thought that the Serpent Mound, like many other mound building cultures of the area, like the Hopewell, appears astronomically aligned and can be visibly connected to astronomical events like eclipses. This brings us to the topic of indigenous knowledge as it compares and relates to Western astronomy.
Now that we've introduced the ideas of ethnoastronomy and archaeoastronomy with examples from across North America, let's dig into how these concepts relate to what we've been taught as modern scientific astronomy. My name is Emily Kay, and I'm here with my co-hosts Olivia Burghardt and Becca Shively, who will help me break down these academic ideas into a more listener-friendly dialogue. I'm going to start by clarifying that the three of us are not Indigenous, nor do we have ties with any Indigenous communities. However, this conversation is informed by conversations and interviews with members of Indigenous communities, such as the Autumn of Durango, Mexico, as well as extensive research into different Indigenous astronomical traditions and the relationship between Indigenous knowledge and scientific knowledge. We encourage anyone looking for more information on these topics to look for sources coming directly from Indigenous communities. So, Olivia and Becca, am I correct in thinking you both, like me, attended public school in the United States?
Yes, I mean, I did, yeah.
I went to public school up until about third grade, and then I actually ended up going to a private Christian school from third to 12th grade. So kind of a mixture of public and private.
Okay. Yeah, I went to public school up through my sophomore year of high school, and then I was homeschooled my last 2 years. But the majority of my educational experiences have been in public school. Where did you guys go to school or roundabouts?
About 30 minutes north of Cincinnati.
I went to a school kind of in the suburbs of Columbus, so in Westerville, and then my private school was also in the Westerville and kind of Worthington area.
And I went to high school in both West Tennessee and East Tennessee. Do you guys recall ever learning about Indigenous knowledge of any topic, but specifically astronomy, like how Indigenous tribes have studied the skies and how they've used that knowledge and stuff like that?
So I don't think I ever learned about astronomy ever in public school, but my Indigenous knowledge is also incredibly limited. I know that in my public high school, middle school, and elementary school, we only really talked about U.S. history and like the very limited Indigenous aspect of the colonialist era.
Yeah, I agree. I remember a little bit of astronomy in middle school, kind of. It was like a unit in my science class, but we didn't necessarily address any differences in beliefs between like the Western tradition and Indigenous tradition. And in terms of just anything relating to Indigenous cultures, the main thing that I think of is when I took AP US History and we talked about like the displacement or things like the Carlisle boarding school in Pennsylvania and a lot of the colonialist ideas of trying to, for lack of a better term, exterminate Indigenous viewpoints from North America.
I think I have a similar experience. We mostly learned about Indigenous cultures through the history of our state, like how the state was founded, and we talk a lot about it then, mostly in middle school. But then other than that, a lot of, you know, the traditional like Thanksgiving, the pilgrims, all of that. And it seems like it's typically all lumped together, like all Indigenous cultures are just referred to as Native Americans. Unless we were talking about the specific founding of Tennessee, we didn't really name drop any specific culture. And we didn't talk about the Ojibwe or the Cherokee or the Miamia. It was just kind of all lumped together like they were all the same.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because my entire district, their schools were mostly named after Indigenous communities. Not going to name drop, but I just think it's interesting that our entire district is built off of these people's names, but we'd never talk about it. Like, I didn't even realize in elementary school that my elementary school was named after this group of people. I mean, like, I did a little bit, but I didn't really think about it, and it definitely wasn't talked about. So I just think that's kind of interesting about how public school works in regards to Indigenous existence.
Yeah, one thing that I forgot to mention when I was talking about my school was before I ended up getting to middle school, I have two older sisters, and my oldest sister actually took part in something my school called the Thanksgiving Feast, where you could choose to dress up as a pilgrim or a Native American, which is just so messed up. So there's pictures floating around of students who went to my middle school in kind of costumey, mocking versions of Indigenous clothing. And looking back on it, that feels absolutely insane that even existed. And they did away with that by the time I got to middle school, thank God. But yeah, it's just the way that most schools, or at least the schools that I have experienced, did not treat Indigenous knowledge or culture or anything with much respect, it seems.
Yeah, I feel like I remember as a kid making those crafts where they have the cardboard paper like headband with the the feathers on it, which in hindsight is really not appropriate for a bunch of white 9-year-olds.
It's like a caricature of the culture.
Yeah, and the fact that we didn't even talk a whole lot about these cultures other than to celebrate Thanksgiving feels very disrespectful when we could have at least talked a little bit more about them specifically. So I feel like most of the time, prior to learning about these topics at a university, people really just kind of talk about Indigenous knowledge or traditions in a derogatory way, or to say that these traditions were like backwards or primitive compared to modern Western knowledge. Has that been your experience?
I think just the fact that my school didn't talk about it at all is kind of implying that it's irrelevant. Like, oh, it doesn't matter, so we're not even going to teach it, or it's not part of our curriculum because it's not relevant again. So I think even if they don't like necessarily say outright or imply outright, oh, this stuff is not like contemporary or should be really considered in the modern day, just because they didn't talk about it at all. Like they just said, yeah, don't matter.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel that any time it was brought up, it was, like we said earlier, brought up in the context of the first Thanksgiving, which was in the early days of America as a nation. And also any other time it was brought up, it was kind of in the context of like manifest destiny and westward expansion. So it wasn't necessarily even talking about their cultures. It was just talking about a specific culture or group being displaced for westward expansion. So it wasn't even addressing their cultures or their knowledge or their traditions, just the fact that we were trying to remove them.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, like, people don't consider the importance of the indigenous people of North America at all, like, especially in the context of, like, the Protestants coming over here. And, like, they would have died without the indigenous people helping them out, only for us to push them away and, like, consider them not relevant outside of, like, American history and what happened. So I just, yeah.
Yeah, and in the way that we're talking about it, we're like referencing it as if it's just history and it's not also that their cultures and traditions are still around today. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. It's like the way that it's ingrained in our brains to think about them as historic cultures and not also modern day cultures.
Yeah, and with how we talk about indigenous cultures with like the Puritans and stuff, that has been kind of a constant theme around like indigenous history throughout the field of American history. Is thinking about indigenous people as part of the wilderness of America as a continent. And so the more we, as, you know, white Americans expanded our territories, we conquered the wilderness and therefore like they were considered part of like that wilderness to be conquered. And it kind of has othered them constantly, like from the start. They've always been not of like the modern world and not of like the present day. They've always been something aside.
How do you guys think that indigenous knowledge of astronomy relates to what is traditionally taught in schools, what we might call modern scientific astronomy?
Before this class, I barely knew anything about astronomy, except for maybe like the pop culture-y zodiac sort of stuff, which isn't even the same thing as astronomy. But I'm not a big science person, so I can't really speak on what I know.
So for clarification, my experience with the field of astronomy, I'm not an astronomer. I've definitely worked around the fields of like space study and the study of the sky in the past, but never in my experience about learning about the sky and the stars or anything related to space has the way that indigenous people learn about or never has their knowledge or how they use that knowledge, never has that come up. You know, so we'll sometimes talk about, you know, the constellations and sometimes like the Chinese zodiac, for example, would come up. But never did we talk about indigenous beliefs that are like similar in that vein. You would think that that would be more relevant to us because of the physical proximity. You would think that indigenous knowledge or indigenous traditions would come up at any point in that discussion, but it doesn't.
Yeah, kind of in the same vein as you're talking about the Chinese zodiac and not indigenous perspectives. I feel like in a lot of spaces we're talking about like the history of something, it's always Greece and Rome. And I'm saying that as a classical civilizations major, so I spend a lot of time in spaces talking about the Greco-Roman world. But we talk so much about how there's gods and goddesses of the sun and the moon and how that influenced their life. But especially when we spoke to Dr. John Henderson, he talked about the Mayan and Mexica goddesses of the moon or gods of the sun. So there are different cultures who have very similar things, but we haven't addressed that in the same way. And I think there is a lot that we can obviously take from these cultures. Like there are still lunar calendars that a lot of these groups have used and are still using today, which shows that they knew what they were talking about if they're still in use today. Like I don't really know how to explain it. I feel that we've just been doing a disservice to people who have always known what they were talking about.
Yeah, a little bit of a white supremacy thing going on here where it's you only really center European history and their perspectives. Like you never talk about constellations in any other context really besides like the Greek or Roman names. Like, oh, you've heard of like Sirius or Cassiopeia or something like that. That's pretty much all you really remember about constellations is their name.
Or their relationship to the zodiac and celestial beliefs and, you know, your horoscope and all that. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like really, if we do talk about indigenous knowledge, it's almost always as myth or as a belief system and not necessarily in the more utilitarian aspect of it. We don't talk about how they have used the sun or the moon or different star positions to do things such as like farming or hunter-gathering or to align their festivals with certain seasons and things like that. We only ever talk about, oh, they thought the snake was eating the moon or, you know, like it, we never talk about how those beliefs correlated to something that had a use in their everyday life and not just a religious take.
I think the separation between mythology and religion is very interesting too, because I mean, people likely still believe in some of these like things that we consider mythology. And I think mythology, like as a term, relates mostly to historic things that happen and not necessarily like current religion. Like, you wouldn't really call, like, Christian mythology mythology because it's a religion. Because then you're like, oh, well, that's not as serious or something like that. But then you'd consider something like Hopewell mythology as only mythology because it's like, as we said earlier, indigenous cultures are mostly based in history and not in contemporary living.
Yeah, it almost seems like using the term mythology means that it's not true, kind of, because it's a myth versus fact, because anyone who refers to something as a religion means that there are people that think the religion is true, I guess. But if you read myths, like, you know, it's just mythology. They're just cool stories. It's like it's removing a certain degree of validity that should be there. It just kind of makes it feel like people aren't taking it seriously, acting like indigenous cultures don't know and haven't known what they're talking about when they do.
And I mean, what is truth? I mean, when you really get down to it, we've talked a lot off mic about science being like another belief system. We like to think that it's different because it's like, you know, facts, you know, provable and all that. But like believing in something gives it power.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's funny you mentioned that. Because as we're recording this, I was taking a sociological research methods class, and we talked a lot about the objectivity of science and the subjectivity of science and like objective reality. And I'm not going to get into the whole like terms and...
We already use enough big words.
Yeah. So it's like science, you have to believe in it for it to be true. But that doesn't necessarily make it objective because you're like, how do you know what you're looking at is actually reality? And how do you know that the people that are looking at this thing know that it's reality? It's just science. I think it's an important thing to realize that it's also a belief system, even if it's not similar or exactly the same as religion.
Yeah. What you just said, I don't know why, reminded me of something kind of back in my middle school days. I had a science teacher who always said that science is something observable, measurable, and testable. And what we were talking about earlier is that a lot of these groups used their knowledge about the sky for farming, for harvest time. So they were observing it, they were measuring it, they were testing it, and they used that knowledge for their everyday life. And the fact that we don't necessarily consider that in the same vein as modern knowledge and modern astronomy all of a sudden makes no sense to me.
I mean, now that you say that, I'm like, yeah, I mean, you could definitely make, like, you did a little Venn diagram of religion and religious practices and scientific practice. There is a lot of overlap. So you shouldn't have them to be completely separated because they're not that separate.
And this isn't to say that we're like, you know, don't believe in the scientific facts or whatever, but it's more so to say that, like, we maybe should expand the idea of, like, what is truth and, like, what is fact. You know, I'm a history graduate student, so we talk extensively about the idea that the historical record is not always reliable. It is not always truth in the sense that we like to think of truth, because everything that we know about history, especially events that we did not ourselves observe and that we only rely on written records or artifacts to kind of retell that story, those sources are biased in some way. Someone wrote those things down, and that someone had a perspective, a specific perspective, and they came from a specific background, and they interpreted what was happening through a specific lens. And so to say that indigenous knowledge is not truth, it's just mythology or something, it's like, well, I mean, how much can we really rely on what we think of as fact?
Mic drop.
Thank you for listening to Eclipsing History.
This episode was designed and recorded by Burkhardt, Kay, and Shively, students of the Public History Program at Bowling Green State University, under the direction of Drs. Dong and Chalu. Mid-Story mixed and edited the episode. We thank our interviewees, John Henderson, George Ironstruck, Brad Lepper, Esteban Rios, and Talon Silverhorn.
Landon Cena composed the original music for the podcast. Ohio Humanities provided financial support. To access other episodes and additional content, go to bgsu.edu/eclipsinghistory.